E nā reo, e rōrangatira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, katoa. Greetings and welcome everyone, and a special welcome to Theodore for coming and sharing his time and knowledge with us today. My great pleasure to introduce Theodore to you. He tells us he spent 25 years in the corporate world before his journey via storytelling and listening to Inspiral and Lumio. In watching and listening to this week's feature TV program, What Next, and also our order of service a couple of weeks ago, there seems to be a theme coming through that we are moving from a black and white world to a more grey world. We're moving perhaps more to community, away from individuality, and we also face lots of challenges just today in terms of equality and the future and what that might bring. And part of that is, how are we going to work together? How are we going to collaborate? How are we going to make that work? So I think what Theodore is offering today is very timely, will be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I gather this is the last in a series of conversations you've been holding. So I hope that we can kind of round it off in a way which is useful to you. If there are themes and ideas from earlier talks that you feel are relevant to today, please bring them forward. What we're going to do today is meet each other to begin with, and then we're going to have a discussion in groups, and then I'll try to give you some of the thoughts from the kind of frontier that I've been working at, and then hopefully we'll have a moment for you to reflect on those in the light of the conversation we've had today. So the first part of this is really just work for each of you in groups around something that my colleagues call whanaunatanga, which is the work of understanding where we come from, what is the community we belong to, and how would we best like to use today. If you could just spend a few minutes in your groups discussing that together. Bernard, who's helping me at the back here, and I will just kind of circulate and help if there's any help needed. So please just spend a few minutes, each of you, introducing yourselves to one another and saying, you know, what is it you're bringing, and what do you hope to receive from today? Thank you.
Can I interrupt for a moment? We just want to do another little something now before I talk to you. What we'd like each group to do is to try to bring forward, or people within the group, to try to bring forward some examples of moments of frustration and difficulty in working in groups. Can you think of times, and I was already hearing the beginnings of some here, when something has really bothered you about the way a group is trying to work and isn't quite succeeding? Be lovely to have just a few
specific examples, and then we'll ask you to bring those forward to the whole discussion. So, you know, it's not compulsory for everyone to have one, but just some that immediately come to mind, if you could bring them forward in your group. Thank you. Can I ask you all now to do something that's slightly challenging? I wonder if each group could, if one person could maybe tell all of us a little bit about the stories that have come forward, rather than hand it around to everyone. So if you could nominate someone in the group who's willing to speak for that conversation, that'd be good.
In our group, we in sharing our various stories, we were looking at the difficulty sometimes of individuals being brought into organisations and having to comply with the requirements of that organisation. I use the example from my point of view of a new resident coming into a rest home, and the difficulties that there can be when an individual comes in and then has to be part of the group. But we all know, I'm sure, because we were sharing some other experiences of volunteer organisations, that individuals in volunteer organisations don't necessarily go all that well together all the time, because people have their own ways of viewing things. So it's interesting, I'm going to be interested to see where we're going to end up with this. Is that a reasonable, is that where we were at?
Public speaking isn't my forte. But yes, the group, let me see, we started first seeing that leadership, so there has to be a purpose, and I think that really fitted. And so that the talking needs to be lead to action, but sometimes we get stuck on the talking, we don't get the action, or we get the action without the talking, and that both's needed. And so the leadership is so that there is a, I think what came through for me is that the frustration sometimes of finding the common purpose that we all are through. And then the last bit at the end, and I think this comes down to, and I will say, is language at the moment, is the understanding of what words mean to different people. And finding now with diverse, and this is me speaking, that with diversity, you pick up the vibes for, and I was using the word because it happened this morning to me, the word colonization. Now, the word colonization is a very divisive word. And I was, and it can be really astounded to find it means two complete opposite meanings for different people. So some for it's good and some it sees as a bad. So that's, and in this more diverse thing as a group is actually finding the common language so then you can do a common cause and get to a common.
Yeah.
Is this a sort of meta or is it we're talking about the actual incidents? So Pam gave a very good example of the St Andrew's Trust and how we're taking off in a different direction, and we think we're heading in the right direction, but you know we're clearly losing some of our audience in terms of the people who've traditionally come to these lectures, which have often had a theological focus, and so there's a level of anxiety about how we build our audience in doing something that we all think is really valuable to be doing. I gave an example of I'm working with Scoop Media at the moment, and we're doing an online housing debate using a really smart artificial intelligence tool. But with the best will in the world, we've come to a point where we are not certain about how we scope the scale of the debate. Should it be it's about affordable housing, so should it be affordable housing across the board or just in the private sector? And we've each got very good ideas about why it needs to be broadly based or quite specific. And we're currently at a bit of an impasse, you know. So it's kind of interesting to see, even with incredible goodwill, you can still find blocks that prevent, you know, goodwill, good communication, on the same page, we all thought, and all of a sudden something kind of comes out of left field that throws it off track.
Thank you, Jan. I think the conversations we've had so far really do bring out one of the foundational ideas that I have learned about the difference between conversations that are productive and conversations that are less productive, or groups that work well and groups that work less well. And the distinction which was taught to me by a dear friend of mine who's now no longer with us, is between talk that is called aboutness talk and talk that is withness talk. So let me try and explain this difference. When we're in aboutness talk, the subject of our discussion is something over there. It's beyond us. We talk as though we're very distant from the topic. Typically in aboutness talk, we're trying to explain something to other people. And it is the standard discourse of most public forums, of scientific discussions. You know, the thing that we are trying to get at is this important topic that's over there from which we are detached. But in aboutness talk, in withness talk, by contrast, we are absolutely ourselves engaged. We speak from within our own experience. We bring ourselves to the conversation, and it's by doing that that we make a different kind of space between us. When we engage with other people and we allow our own experience, our own feelings, to become part of the discussion, we make room for other people to do the same thing, to bring their feelings and their experiences into the conversation. And so it's a different kind of exchange. And this is something that I've been learning about. How do we So because that exchange in which we are present, in which our sort of difficulties and frustrations we admit to others, encourage other people to do the same thing, and then we start to be on the same tram. There was this, you made this point about the purpose. The purpose is always important, of course, in any gathering. But I found that it's really useful if that purpose can emerge from the collective wishes and aspirations of the people in the group, rather than being something that's imposed from the outside. Now, so what I want to do today is just give you a little history of the work that I've been involved in, and I have to get around behind this. I probably should move this, shouldn't I, somehow? But anyway, I want to start the story. No, I'm fine. I want to start with something I've recognized, because I'm an old guy, and what I'm remembering now is my experience of going to work in Wellington at my first job in 1968, which is, you know, an awful long time ago. And it happened that I joined a company called Philips, which used to occupy a building in Wakefield Street near where Te Papa is now. And the thing that strikes me when I remember that time, when I remember the feeling of going to work, was what a joyful experience it was. It was an organization that was really in its heyday. It was thriving. We had, I think, 600 or 700 employees throughout New Zealand. We were in a vast range of businesses, from professional ones to consumer businesses. And there was a spirit in the place that invited us to become engaged with one another and to be creative. For example, one of the company policies was that if you invented something on the company's time, and especially if you patented it, you know, you were entitled to, you and the company had half shares in whatever you came up with. You know, which now, looking back, seems an incredibly enlightened idea. But of course, it encouraged people to be creative. So I remember an organization of inventions. We were busy developing new things. We in the time I was there, we invented the Philips Record Club, for example, which was hugely successful in the days of long-playing records. There were products in the medical services area that were invented. But mostly what I remember is the feeling of being present in that place. If, for example, we bumped into one another in the corridor, we would typically have a conversation about what is each of us up to and then start to try and solve one another's problems. Now, I don't want to idealize this. All I'm saying is that I can remember a time when going to work was not like the experience that I hear people telling me about today. So something really important has changed. Something significant has changed, and I think it's got a long history. So the thing that I pick as the most significant shift in organizational life has been the rise and industrialization of the business school, and then the plethora of consulting firms that business schools developed, which slowly and then increasingly has created a shroud over organizations, in the sense that good ideas are now supposed to come from outside the organization. If there's a problem, you don't try and solve it yourself. You pay some well-paid outsider to come and fix it for you. But in many, many different ways, the interpersonal currency of working life has changed enormously since those days I remember 50 years ago. In ways that now I see as increasingly less human. For example, the emphasis on measurement is huge now in ways that didn't exist. If we take this to its extreme, the most recent phenomenon of working life is the rise of the so-called gig economy. People who are no longer actually employed by an organization and don't belong to an organization, but are paid to do tasks that are set for them by some remote entity that operates over the internet. And what's really sad about the gig economy is that there's actually no social interaction at all. If you work for Uber or TaskRabbit, you are discouraged from any kind of conversation with other people who are doing the same job. And this is a deeply worrying development, a deeply inhuman way of behaving. And so it's not surprising that those skills of collaboration that we're now beginning to recognize as important have become atrophied, have faded from view. We are really, in many ways, isolated individuals struggling to make sense of one another in our daily encounters. So the work that I'm most passionately involved in is trying to do something serious and practical about this. And it turns out that there are other ways of behaving than this dominant, instrumental, individually focused, managerial one that all of our organizations, including government, have now adopted and accepted as the only way to work. But this is a view that comes from the margins rather than from the mainstream. And it's got deep roots, just as the way we're working now has deep roots, because we can trace the roots of individualism and managerialism, and indeed, the notion of scientific objectivism. We can trace those back at least 400 years to the work of René Descartes and the philosophy of individual self-determination, which was largely his and Newton's invention. But there has always been a counter view that actually we're not individual creatures after all. We like everything else, inhabit a world, and we belong and are attached and are part of that world, and our actions are actually deeply influenced by the way that world operates. And this is called phenomenology. And it's an idea and a philosophy that's had many twists and turns, especially in the last 150 years, but is now beginning to assert itself as a practical basis for everyday action. And that's the work that I'm involved in. So it starts with the notion of a goal for us, not as individuals, but as members of functioning groups, with the idea that it's possible to reach a state that is called by my friend John Schotter poised resourcefulness, a sense that we are ready to make the most of whatever comes along by dint of the fact that we are part of a group, not operating as an individual. It is about recognizing and using our differences. It starts with the idea that we're not all the same. In fact, each of us sits in the world in slightly different ways. We are interested in different things. We notice different things. We're drawn to different things. And those differences are potentially very powerful and very useful. If only we can articulate them, recognize them, not only in ourselves, but in those with whom we're working. And what's really interesting is that this work of understanding difference and recognizing and paying attention to our ways of being, it's not intellectual work. It's not something we have to go to university to study. It's practical work. It's because it's essentially based in the human body. So paying attention to ourselves as living, embodied creatures is actually a really useful thing to do. And the reason is that our bodies are incredibly powerful instruments of attention and noticing. So, for example, when we are in a situation when something really strikes us, you know, we have this kind of feeling. The hairs go up on the back of our neck. Or we can be in a situation and suddenly feel that something's not right here. We can feel deeply uneasy about things. And those kinds of messages are always important and useful. And if we can learn to respect those messages and pay them attention and then to give voice to them, we can start to work with others in a really useful way. But we have to have the courage and to be able to do that. And so a lot of the work that I'm involved with is about creating environments in which people feel sufficiently encouraged and welcome so that these little difficulties that we all encounter can actually come to the surface and be expressed. It turns out, for example, that if you do have this feeling that something's going on that isn't really working for you, and you say so, there's someone else bound to be able to say the same thing. Except you hadn't found words to express it. Somebody said in the earlier conversation that language was important, and yes, it's true. Language is absolutely foundational. What we are working on is a way to help people discover what is my muscle? What is the thing that in every ordinary situation I kind of naturally work on, I'm interested in, I'm drawn to? And if you can recognize your own muscle and you can recognize the muscles of others you're with, then you have a really strong basis for this puzzle of collaboration, because collaboration is about using differences. So we're busy trying to develop a language around this notion of distinctive muscles. You know, when I'm in a situation and my mind starts to build a visual image of what's going on, that's a kind of muscle. That's the language of a muscle of visualization. Or when I'm in a situation and I'm angry, I feel very emotionally challenged, that's another kind of muscle. It's my I have a sort of an emotional muscle, but both of those examples don't necessarily lead to the decision about what to do unless you have a conversation in which it's possible to express these things and to say, look, I'm feeling really angry, and giving someone else a chance to say, well, what is it you're angry about? And then you can uncover and unpack these things. So it turns out that the work of, if we come back to our notion of aboutness and withness, in aboutness conversation, the topic of the discussion is always on the surface and it's over there. But in withness conversation, we start to go deeper and uncover our own responses to things. Then if we can find words to address those, we can actually begin to get into a different relationship with one another that is more productive. So this is like a meta task. There is the work that we're trying to do, and then there's the how are we going to do the work. And the how are we going to do the work is this business of recognizing one another, of being able to stop and say, Jan, You used that word, that big word, and it obviously means something to you. Can you say more about that? So the meta conversation is being able not only to do the work, but to have a conversation about the conversation that you're having. So we're doing those two things. We're working at these two levels simultaneously. We're working together to solve a problem, and we're also working together to make sure that we're on the same wavelength and that we're recognizing one another in a sensible way. And what becomes possible with this kind of work is that you develop a kind of organic sense within a group where the task of leadership or the task of dealing with whatever comes up, it's instinctively obvious who is the right person in any particular situation. It's not about one person having to be the guide, but it's rather like the All Black team when I'm about to be tackled and in an instant I decide whether I'm going to do my flick pass to the left or to the right. And I know that the guy on the right has a sidestep that will get him past the guy who's running me down. So that's where it goes. He's the best placed person for the next move. And it's possible to develop the same faculty in group work, in ordinary conversation, to know that the best placed person to deal with this next thing that's coming up is the person with that particular skill or that particular need. Now, this might sound highfalutin, but the fact is I've experienced this working in practice. For example, at Toi Whakaari, the New Zealand Drama School, there are a group of teachers who've spent enough time together that they can work with 150 students in the room, and they know which person is best placed to answer the questions that come up. And they don't have to talk to each other about it. It's become completely embodied and instinctive. So this is the other part of this work, is recognizing that skilled practice of any kind eventually ends up being something that is embodied. It's no longer conscious, it's no longer something we have to think about, but it's something that is so deeply inside us that our bodies tell us what to do. And therefore it's very efficient. These are actually lessons from ancient history, and especially from the world of pre-literate indigenous peoples. And this is still only partly recognized, that in the shift from oral-based cultures to written cultures, actually not only were some important things gained, but some important things were lost as well. And it's hard for us to recognize those because being literate is so deeply embedded in our sensibility now. But we can glimpse it through moments. And I managed to glimpse some of this through my exposure to Te Ao Māori when I was at Toi Whakaari. But I'll give you just one example that really sits with me. In the 1920s, a Russian philologist and experimenter who was a pupil of Lev Vygotsky, who's quite well known in educational thinking, called Alexander Luria, traveled to the north part of Russia to meet and talk with members of tribal groups in that remote part of the country who had not become literate, who were still orally based. And in order to try to understand the way that they think and research their way of being compared to people who knew about writing, he devised a series of what he called syllogisms, questions he'd put to people, and then understand on the basis of their answers how they thought and how that was different from the way we think. And there's one that really struck me. He spoke to a 37-year-old peasant, a man who was inhabiting one of these tribes. He sat down with him in a tent, and he put his hand on the table like this, and he said, "Now, this is the researcher asking the question. Here are four people. This person is an adult. This person is also an adult. And this third one is an adult, but this one is a child. Which is the odd one out?" That's the kind of category puzzle that we deal with in primary school. And the peasant looked at him and said, "You need all of them." He said, "You need all of them, because while these three people are doing the work, the child can fetch the materials they need to keep going, so they don't have to stop and go and get the materials themselves." This was, you know, just a completely different way of thinking. One that was much more interested in the practicalities of life than in the sort of theory of whether something belongs to this category or the other category. But it's a profound shift. And in that holistic view that the peasant had, the pre-literate peasant had, there's some very important understanding that we, I believe, in some ways have lost sight of or are in danger of losing sight of. So one of the great lessons for me from my time at Toi Whakaari was Teina Moetara, who was the Maori teacher, telling me that in the world that he knew, he grew up on a marae in, he was Ronga Whakata in the south of Gisborne. And he said, you know, we, in my whanau or in my iwi, we see people's differences. We use differences as resources for one another. And that sense of things really struck me very forcibly. What if we could use our differences as resources for one another, not as reasons for putting one another in different categories, as we so easily do? What if those differences could be turned into practical assets, attributes in our everyday working? And that's what Bernard and I are now busily engaged in, is developing methods, working methods, everyday working methods that allow us to make use of these differences in a practical way. The one we are particularly focused on at the moment is called Theatre of Change. And Theatre of Change is a workshop of about 3 hours for groups of people who have some kind of shared purpose. And in this workshop, we basically invite everyone to experience something together. We enact a small piece of theatre, which is like a scene from workplace life, fairly ordinary scene. And then we ask everyone in the group to say, what did you notice? What struck you? And as people reveal what they notice, we help them to identify what work they're doing in that noticing. It turns out that what we notice is a really good clue to how we operate in the world. We notice what interests us and what matters to us most. And it turns out that for each of us, what matters is something a little bit different. But if we put those matterings together, we can build something really powerful. And that's what this work in Theatre of Change does. It invites everyone to start to pay attention, not only to their own natural muscles of noticing, but to other people's, and then to begin the work of putting those together, to do things together that they couldn't do by themselves. So that's what the Human Methods Lab and what we're about. So in the kind of time remaining, I'm wondering if you might go back into your groups and see how what I've talked about might be relevant to the kinds of puzzles and problems you were discussing, and see if we can see any practical steps forward that we could take when we leave this place and go back to our ordinary lives. Thank you very much.
Well, we've got involved in several really interesting conversations, I could see, that could go on for hours. But it's coming up to 2:55, so I'd like to sum up. And I'd like to thank Theodore very, very much for a very interesting and thought-provoking session that could go on for you know, we could take a... I'd love to do some more of this, I think. And I suspect others might as well. Yeah. So I'd like to say thank you very much for being the person who has brought me to think about withness and aboutness, and that's something that's quite live for me at the moment. I've also been somebody who's been in the workforce for a long time, so I'm thinking about my early experiences of work and how they've changed, and I often blame spreadsheets. You talked about measurement, and I think that spreadsheets have got a lot to answer for in terms of how they tell us who we are and what we are, and actually that completely understates our humanity. So, I think it's been a very fitting end to our human flourishing set of lectures. So, thank you very much, Theodore. Yeah. Oh, right, just a little something.